So, welcome everybody to Politics in the Pulpit. And this is a lectionary-based preaching resource designed to ask the tough questions that emerge when the set readings for next Sunday collide with what's going on in the world. This is my first hosting, and it's a great privilege to be doing it. I'm Michael Wakelin. I was at the BBC for many years. I'm now very proud to be Executive Chair of the Religion Media Centre. .org.uk. Do please visit it. I'm also executive producer of Pause for Thought, and we'll be thinking about that a bit more in a moment or two. I'm also part of a thing called the Religion and Belief Literacy Partnership, which helps to bring religious literacy into the workplace. And that's quite an ongoing project at the moment, which has got a few exciting developments behind it. And I might say a bit more about that over the weeks ahead. But fortunately, I'm not the main person on this podcast. I'm joined by someone much more interesting and much wiser. I'm very pleased to say that Dave Tomlinson is with us. Dave is an Anglican vicar. He is also an author and he's a broadcaster and he's chaplain to St. Ethelburga's. I didn't know that about you, Dave. But the main reason why he's so interesting, I think, are the books he's written, including The Post-Evangelical and How to Be a Bad Christian and a Better Human Being, that some of you might know about, that was lodged. Well, it resided in our downstairs loo for quite a long time and was dipped into regularly. And I want to hear a little bit more about that. But I know Dave best because of Pause for Thought, where he's one of our most distinguished and longest serving broadcasters. He now regularly appears with Zoe Ball at 7:20 in the morning on Radio 2. And he's a real master of the art of Pause for Thought. So maybe just a quick word about how you do that so well, Dave.
Well, it is a very specific form of communication, isn't it?
It is
Michael, and
2 minutes,
yeah,
360
that's right.
words.
And I think it took me a while to kind of quite get the hang of that. But I had good training, good help from Hannah, who's part of your team in particular. And I think that really what one's trying to do for that particular audience at that time of day is something hopefully which will be uplifting, which will help them to look at their day, which may be full of who knows what, a little more positively. And I find the best way to do that is with a story. So for me, that's my starting point. I want to find a story and then try and work out what it might say. And I'm someone who sort of seems to live a fairly dramatic life in many ways. So there's often stories that crop up. And it's interesting that I found that it doesn't always work this way, but I've found over the years that one of the places where I find best inspiration is in the garden. And so quite often, I mean, I can't sort of work long term there, but quite often when I'm just looking for an idea or thought, I find that sitting there feeling perhaps a gentle breeze, well, actually I've sat out in the freezing cold sometimes and had a friend of Pat's bringing out a cup of tea to me because I looked like I was now frozen solid. But there's something about being in nature, I find, that is very inspiring. So that's where I tend to start off often.
Well, I always tell people stories, stories, stories. I mean, how did Jesus communicate? He told stories, so it's obviously
Absolutely.
the best way to get things across. But you also have written some interesting books, as I mentioned, and How to Be a Bad Christian clearly was an eye-catching title for a book. Did it get you into much trouble?
Well, I had to initially persuade Hodder, the publisher, to do it, really. I remember when I sat down for lunch with my editor and her boss, excuse me, and they said, "How wedded are you to this title?" So I said, "Quite wedded, really. I think if I didn't have that title, it would be another book. The title is kind of the book, really." And but they were worried that perhaps the kind of the Christian bit would put off the wider audience, who I was very keen to reach, because in a way I see it as, perish the word, but I see it as my own form of evangelism, really. I'm trying to reach beyond the boundaries of the church. So they thought the Christian might be off-putting there, and that bad would be off-putting to their sort of reliable religious audience. And I said, "Well, do you know what? I have tried that title out on a lot of people, atheists, Christians, and it invariably brings a smile, at least." So I said, "You try it out." So I think they're rather pleased that they did now. But
This.
of course, the title was actually inspired by, I'm a big sort of bird lover, as you'll know from Pause for Thought, and I was inspired by an incredible book by Simon Barnes called How to Be a Bad Bird Watcher. And it's a magnificent book, really. And really, it's a tract for his passion, really, bird watching. He's sort of approaching it from the perspective of saying, well, you think you don't know much about birds. Well, let's think about that. You know, a robin and a blackbird and a, you know, da da da. And it really doesn't matter whether you know the difference between a greenfinch and a goldfinch in order to enjoy them. So he says, you look out of a window, you see a bird, you enjoy, congratulations, you are a bird watcher. And that kind of made me think, oh gosh, I need to write a book because I kind of think I'm a bit about God like that, really. I think that God belongs to everyone, not just to the religious geeks and twitchers. That God, in some shape or form, is part of everybody's life, recognized or not. And so I suppose the book is starting from that point and then trying to draw them into a journey, really. That's how the book came about.
Well, I'm certainly a bad Christian. I'm also a bad bird watcher. I love my birds too. So we have a lot in common, I think, me and you.
Yes.
But you're famous initially. I think the first time I ever heard about you was that you had opened a church and a pub. How long ago was that? And did that is the church and the pub still going?
It isn't, no, but that was actually right at the beginning of 1990, and I'd had a background prior to that as a leading figure in the kind of house church movement in this country, and I'd kind of gone through quite a crisis about all of that, and felt more and more like a square peg in a round hole, and so I'd kind of left. It was almost like career suicide, really, because we were kind of well founded, and leaving all that with not knowing where we did belong. But I did have our kids, and I did have some of their friends, and I had a few other people around who were all pretty disaffected with church. And what I discovered then is that there's a lot of people like that. And so when we started off in our house, actually, and then when somebody said, can we meet in a pub, I thought, well, I don't know if that is even a thing, But Pat, who is my wife, who is a safer person for going on a pub crawl than me. She went round checking out pubs and found one at Clapham Common, which and so we were there for 10 years. And over those 10 years, there were thousands actually of people who passed through Holy Joe's. It was somewhere that people came to for a while, people particularly whose faith was unraveling and they didn't know if it would ever go back together again. And this was a place where it wasn't someone telling you this is what you're supposed to believe, but really giving the space for people to explore that for themselves with a bit of guidance. And out of that, actually, six or seven people became ordained, including me, who found a home in the Church of England, which has been served me well, and I hope I've served them well.
Well, you may or may not be pleased to hear that there is a church opening in a pub in the village I live in that I heard about only yesterday.
Fantastic.
It's just opened up apparently, so I'm going to
That's
go and
great.
explore
I mean,
that.
it's interesting, isn't it? There is a parallel, and often in villages, these are the two things that sit there. And I have thought sometimes of writing a book about Christian church leadership based on the model of a good pub landlord. Because I think there's a lot to learn from a good pub landlord, and there are some bad ones around, but like there are some not so good vicars, but I think that there is a lot that you can learn about being that genial, hospitable host, creating a space where things, can happen. And that's definitely what Holy Joe's was about.
Well, we're going to come to the news shortly, and then we're going to get on to the reading shortly and to hear your wisdom on that. But I've allowed myself just 20 seconds on football. I know it's a massive turn-off for lots of people, but Norwich beat Ipswich on Saturday,
I
which
know.
a Norwich fan is a massive joy. I'm almost ashamed of the deep happiness it brings me. And I know Ipswich supporters, I love them very much. There's no problem with all that, but it does have some kind of Neanderthal effect when you're kind of tribally playing your great rivals. And of course, they were expected to beat us and they didn't. You may now have 5 seconds on Liverpool.
Would you mean the center of the entire universe? Yeah, well, we had a disappointing day yesterday, you know.
I imagine that was a bit frustrating.
Yeah, we had a
Anyway.
draw with Man United, but yeah.
Enough football. Dave, okay, so we're looking at this, the place where politics and our set readings for next week collide, and whether there's any kind of links we can draw between them, looking through the scriptures that we've been set. So I think if you listen to the news at the moment, watch the news, it's so awful that I often can't watch it or listen to it now. But it's very important in a service, I always think, to make sure the intercessions are very relevant to what's going on in the world. And this week, particularly if you think of the things you've seen on the telly, heard on the radio, the Taiwan earthquake, there's terrible violence in Haiti, there's continued suffering in Yemen and Syria, which tend to get forgotten about because the horrible focus is always Gaza at the moment. I was listening to a report from Orla Gehring the other day, about a girl who was rescued from the rubble, and she came round to discover her entire family had been killed, and I burst into tears. Don't often do that, but it was so ghastly, and so I felt so powerless. And we're not here to talk about the politics of it all, but you know, it's painful, isn't it?
Very painful, definitely. And I think, you know, I think it's right that you introduced the intercessions there, because actually this is a very important part of, I think, of a Christian gathering, because it's not a place where we're trying to, you know, say anything, work out theology, you know, or play politics, but it's a place where we come and lay what we're feeling before God. And it's interesting. I mean, the psalm this week is Psalm 4, isn't
Oh,
it?
yes.
Which is would classify really as a psalm of lament and protest, really. I mean, it's thought that it was it was initially thought, or a lot for a long time thought, that it was sort of David speaking to Absalom, to his son, and later that's been sort of, you know, thrown into question. But that doesn't really matter what the background is. It's somebody crying out in anguish about something that's not fair, basically. And I think this is where the Psalms are so important, really, in our worship. I call the Psalms religion from the guts. There's no pretense about trying to be theologically correct or politically correct, or, you know, I mean, some of them are just awful. You know, the famous one, of course, of, you know, wanting to bash the little ones' heads on the stones and so on when the children, when the people were exiled in Babylon. But the point is, it's not trying to say the right thing. This is spilling your guts out to God. And I remember somebody quoting a long time ago, I don't know if it's, I don't know where it is, but somebody said that John Wesley said something to the effect of that we would be far better if we expressed our anger into the bosom of God. Well, if he didn't say it, he should have. Because I think that is, that's precisely what we find in the Psalms. And so I think that that sense of, you know, having a space within our collective gathering to be able to sort of spill our guts out if necessary, you know, to speak out the dilemmas without feeling we've got to resolve them or have some theologically correct solution to them. I think that's very, very important.
They do quite often. They start with that anger and that rage, and my goodness, I've felt that, read the Psalms and thought, how on earth did he know how I was going to be feeling in 2023
Yes.
3 years? But they often come round, don't they, to a much happier ending, and
Yeah,
this one
well,
does too. And having had the grief at the beginning, it's the lovely ending is, you have filled my heart with greater joy than when their grain and new wine abound. I will lie down and sleep in peace, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. I mean, it's a lovely,
yeah, absolutely. And
soothing.
it isn't always because, you know, God had swooped down Superman style and made everything right. It's because there's an inner, they're about an inner journey. And I think Walter Brueggemann, in the Old Testament, you know, theologian, is so helpful here, where he says that he divides the Psalms into three categories. He says there are Psalms of orientation, all's well in the world, you know, everything's fine, thank you, God, you know. There are Psalms of disorientation, where everything's falling apart, and there are songs of Psalms of reorientation, of sort of salvation in some sense entering into the picture. And he makes the point that some psalms actually contain, you know, all three, but particularly the second two of those, as you've just cited. And I think that's a helpful thing, really, and to know that this is what a relationship with God is supposed to be about, not coming to a sort of cosmic encyclopedia with an answer to everything, but coming to a heart that is open to us. There are not necessarily going to be instant or great answers to some of these dire problems, but there's a heart that receives. And also, I mean, I'm a big believer that, that God is a part of the sufferings of the world. Jürgen Moltmann, of course, articulated that so well in his book, The Crucified God. And so it's not God somewhere else, sort of sitting there at a mixing desk, who could possibly press certain buttons and make things happen. But it's a God who's immersed in. And that, of course, is what the whole Christ event is about in itself. So I think having that sense that we are not alone in the cosmos, we're not alone in the diabolical sufferings of the world, doesn't necessarily solve things, but it enables us to shift our consciousness into a different place. And that enables us then sometimes to go out there and make changes in the world, because we're approaching it in a different way.
So, warmly recommend Psalm 4 for inclusion at the service if you can next Sunday. And talking about the Christ event, shall we move on to the reading from Acts chapter 3, 12 to 19,
Yeah,
and see what you made of that? It's
I
a
mean,
very interesting kind of recap, or standing in a slightly different position, looking back on the passion narrative. It's like quite exciting seeing it from a different angle and used in this way.
yeah, I mean, there are some thoughts more generally about resurrection, I'd like to say, but yes, to go right into that passage from Acts. Obviously, this is, well, we don't know exactly how long, but it's shortly after all of these things had taken place. Everything was raw, and yet there was this injection of new life and hope and transformation. And I think that, Peter and John and the others were kind of wrestling all of these mixed emotions and experiences that were going on. And I think that so I mean, Peter puts it right into the political arena. He says, you did this, and you got Pilate involved, and you da da da, and he throws it right out there. And to me, the arrest, the trial, and the crucifixion of Jesus was a deeply political event. And I think that's often lost as we sort of paper over it with a lot of more kind of life hereafter stuff and or personal salvation stuff, whereas the events themselves are very political events. And his riding into Jerusalem on an ass was satire, political satire at its peak, I think. So I think Peter is opening that whole thing up. The interesting thing he does, and there's a big question here, I think, and it depends on what your hermeneutical starting point is, as to how much you feel you can question the rightness of the way that Peter approached it. Because what he did was he sort of spoke to Israel, the Israelites. Well, he is one, actually, but he's speaking to the Israel. I mean, I think it's fair to say that, the responsibility for the arrest and the ultimate execution of Jesus lay with leaders of the community, the temple authorities, and so on. But he kind of goes out and generalizes it, and he speaks to all the people. And was he right in doing that? Was he perhaps being overtaken with his passion, having seen a crowd who were all swaying this way and that way? Because I think in that sort of statement, in that accusation that he made, is a seed which develops in other parts of the New Testament, and ultimately it's sort of a little flame that becomes a great furnace of anti-Semitism in the church throughout history. I mean, there's no question that that's been there, and quite a lot of it comes down to, I mean, you've got a lot in John's Gospel too, where the Jews are spoken about, when I think a more sort of balanced appraisal is you're talking about certain authorities within it. So we're dealing really with politics at that level rather than speaking in this generalized way about the whole masses of people. So it's an interesting one, the Acts, because it sort of it brings those mixed feelings up. I've got such great sympathy with Peter and the boldness with which he stands up and puts out this responsibility on the people. But I've also got a question about the wisdom of exactly how he went about that.
Yeah. I'm interested in the way, something you said a few minutes ago about the earliness of these words. I was talking to an academic at Edinburgh University, a man called Larry Hurtado, who really focuses on the early beginnings of Christianity. And he pointed out that in some of the letters, and Acts is probably a little bit later, but in some of the letters, it's literally written 2 or 3 years at most after the events of the crucifixion and resurrection. And how amazing it is that his followers, Jesus' followers, have turned him into a god, totally blasphemous and heretical at the time. And so quickly, when we can think of people we may have lost in the last 2 years, who we drank with, ate with, walked around with,
yes.
Actually turning him into a god is very extraordinary. And there's a little passage in verse 13 here, 13 to 15, which seems to me to be a very early liturgy developing. And something that was obviously sort of said and repeated quite a lot. It begins, "The God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, the God of our fathers, has glorified his servant Jesus. You handed him over to be killed and you disowned him before Pilate, though he had decided to let him go. You disowned the holy and righteous one and asked that a murderer be released to you. You killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead. We are witnesses of this." That seems to me quite a formulaic, there's almost a rhythm to it.
Yeah, like there is, absolutely.
Three. That they may have sort of repeated it amongst themselves. And I love that line, "You killed the author of life."
Mm.
An amazingly powerful insight.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yet, you know, the whole thing that they're about is the fact that the author of life is not dead, that life is still,
yes,
is still there. In fact, they're in a whole new dimension with a new power.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
And that line, "we are witnesses," of course, is very relevant to the reading from Luke's gospel, if we may turn to that. Luke chapter 24, verses 36 to 48. Now, I don't know what you read on in church on Sunday, but we have the story of doubting Thomas in John's gospel.
Oh,
and
really?
Okay. It's very resonant of that.
Yes.
What would that be like, Dave, I wonder, to be in that room where Jesus suddenly appears?
Yeah, no, well, it does seem to be a sort of parallel passage, doesn't it? And of course, you've got this a lot in the Gospels where you've got sort of different versions. To me, the accuracy of one against another and all that sort of thing is not really a big deal. I don't think that this is not history in the sense that we understand it now. It's not sort of, you know, an accurate biography that's being written of Jesus. These, as you've already intimated, are accounts that were written a long time afterwards in the case of, you know, of Luke's gospel and even more John. And so they're overlaid with their own kind of reflections and theology and so on. I don't have any problem at all with that. I don't feel any compulsion to need to sort of say that everything is kind of like literal history, because then you have all kinds of problems with the kind of synchronizing of them. But it is an amazing story. And I think what is so striking here is, well, there's this whole mysterious weirdness about this body that the stories are telling us Jesus inhabited. Certainly, we can say that whatever else the resurrection was, it was not a resuscitation of a body that sort of came back and sort of carried on as before.
But why do they make the point that in this case, you know, I'm not a ghost, you can see my flesh, you can see my blood, and then he eats some fish?
I know.
But why go to that extent?
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? And it almost feels like the writer is kind of forcing a point here.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's in, you know, what is the reader's response to this? How do we read it? How do we sense it? To me, and what I feel from this is a sort of reinforcement of the basic sort of Christian belief in the resurrection of the body, which to me is a way of saying that bodies matter. And I couldn't help, when I was reading that thing there, of thinking about the bodies which are hungry, you know, the bodies which are in pain, you know, here are the wounds, you know. And so rather than kind of wrestling around with the sort of stuff that in the end is rather speculative, we just don't know. To me, the more kind of concrete thing I take from it is that Christianity fundamentally says bodies matter. Mm-hmm. And that actually is a deeply political stance to take, because when you translate that into our world, then yes, that there are bodies, as we've already said, in Gaza, in Haiti, and all over the place, which are suffering immensely. I always like to bring art, and as well as poetry and sometimes music, into my sermons. And so having some kind of means to project is quite important to me. Excuse me, there's an iconographer called Kelly Lattimore. I don't know if you've heard of him, an American iconographer who is just wonderful in the way in which he can translate the sort of images and stories into today's world. And he's got a fantastically moving icon of that formulation of the Pieta, you know, where Mary is holding the dead body of her son. And he's reconfigured that into an image of George Floyd as the Christ figure. And being held by his mother, and the icon is actually called Mama, and it's an incredibly sort of powerful translating of this story into this world, and saying, you know, it was political then, it's political now, and I think what's important for us particularly is to see where the political implications of the scriptures and these stories are in our world. And that is so wonderfully done in his icon of that. And his resurrection icon sort of takes a similar sort of line, in which there is a clearly black Christ who is arisen, who's coming out. And it looks pretty much like the sort of typical Orthodox icon, except he's sort of placed in a different context. In the background, you can see a sort of city, empire is there, sort of thing. This is something that's happening over against empire. And this black Christ is standing there. And there's the sense of people who are in need of healing, who are in pain and so on, that he's come out. And so it's a kind of, I think it's the resurrection, I think, is a statement of God's commitment to hope for all. And that icon sort of encompasses that. So when I look at those sort of body references in Luke, I'm puzzled, as you and probably most of us are, as to entirely how to make sense of that. But what it speaks to me is of the value, the importance of bodies, and therefore the whole politics of bodies comes into play for me.
What was the name of the artist again you referred to? So that
Kelly Lattimore.
Kelly.
Kelly, yeah, Kelly, and then Lattimore, Latimore. And if anyone wants to check him out, I mean, his work is just astonishing. I mean, the images he has of the Holy Family at the, you know, in the sort of birth narratives and so on, of homeless people, sitting underneath a bridge, a couple with a little baby, or clearly refugee family traveling through the night. There are lots, but there are all kinds. I mean, he's icons of lots of other figures in history too. And I think that actually that's what I love about it, is that I think that approach to iconography is actually an exercise in hermeneutics, mm-hmm. you know, because he's taking a story from here and putting it over there, or bringing it into our world. And I think, to me, that is a great definition of what a sermon is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I've heard some wonderful kind of, you know, Bible expository sort of sermons and so on, you know, which may interest you, but you go away and have your dinner, you know. I think that sermons are basically a hermeneutical exercise because it's translating, you know, the way it's often put in the world of hermeneutics. There's a book called The Two Horizons, and it is about these two horizons. There's a horizon of the text, you know, what was going on there, and that's a kind of limited horizon to us because it's a long way from us. But we try to understand what was the horizon of these people, what were they seeing, what were they thinking, what was going on there. But then there's our horizon here, and the hermeneutical task, and I think the task of preaching, is to try to bring those worlds, those horizons, into some sort of alignment where we can then not just be looking at events in the past, but feeling the impact of them here in our world.
Can we turn our attention to the other reading? We don't have a Hebrew scripture apart from the psalm, obviously. The other reading for this Sunday, which is the third Sunday of Easter, by the way, is from 1 John chapter 3, which, yeah, it kind of picks up on some of those themes. What would you make of this, Dave, and would you bring it into your sermon on Sunday? And how would you bring it into your sermon on Sunday?
If I'm honest, I probably wouldn't. but it's not because I don't like, I love the writings of John, actually, but they are a bit puzzling at times. And I think that probably what I struggle with at times with John is the sort of sense of strong kind of dualism, you know, between the world and you know, the company of believers, or however you want to put it. But I think, to me, a really big key of that in looking at the writings of John is realizing that, a bit like, I don't think that Peter meant all of you Israelites did this. I think that John isn't saying this is the whole world. I think it's talking about the powers at work in the world, the forces at work, which are not necessarily directly human, you know, which may be expressed through structures, through, you know, the sort of cultural manifestations that we have. I think that, you know, when therefore our battle isn't with the world per se, it is with the forces that are at work there, which I think is exactly what the Easter story is about, really. You know, the crucifixion, I think, is as I've said, a deeply political event, in that I think it is Jesus over against empire.
Right.
And John is similarly talking about us, those followers of Jesus, over against the world and the forces and powers at work in the world, which run counter to God's purposes.
It's quite intriguing. There's a sentence in here that I find, you know, sort of tantalizing. And he says, dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known.
Mm.
So I'd have thought being children of God would be, that's kind of the end point, really. That's the wonderful thing. Yet there's this sort of tantalizing idea that we might be something else, but we don't yet know what it is.
Absolutely. No, I think that's very interesting. And I think it's a bit like Paul's comment at the end of 1 Corinthians 13, you know, where the way it's translated commonly is, you know, we see in a mirror.
Yes, yeah.
It's got this dark image. I mean, it's interesting that the actual word that's used there is the word for enigma. You know, he's saying what we see now is an enigma. And there are some more adventurous translations that say a poem or a riddle, because that is actually catching the spirit of what is being said there. This is something enigmatic, something we can't really, you know, and I think that's, you know, and he's speaking about the same thing. We can't see actually where all of this is headed. What we have is the kind of here and now. And and I think it's fine for us to contemplate that, to speculate about it to some extent. But I think what really matters at the end of the day is that here we are now. You know, I wrote a chapter in one of my books, which, if I can remember, it said something like, I believe in life now, the afterlife is beyond my pay grade, something like that, you know, so that, you know, I can afford to be massively agnostic about what things like that really mean. There's an intimation of mystery there.
Yeah.
And there is mystery at the heart of the Christian gospel, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think we don't do any favors by trying to unpack that too much.
Yeah. It is interesting that parallel with Paul looking through a glass darkly. That is, you know, very resonant, isn't it? I think our time's probably coming to a close, Dave. I've been saying preaching on Sunday. Are you actually preaching this Sunday?
No, I'm not actually. I'm going to be listening. But I think that if I gave us a little summary to a lot of what I've been saying, if I could just do that, is that I don't know if you're familiar with the poem by Wendell Berry called Manifesto, and then a dash, The Mad Farmer's Liberation Front. And,
okay.
And of course, Wendell Berry, you know, is a writer and a poet and a farmer, an environmentalist, getting on in years now, but this is his manifesto. But the beautiful thing, and it's quite a complex poem and too long to quote here and now, but it begins by sort of saying, you know, if you accept all the standards and all the expectations of the world around you, you know, of the pressures of this world, this is what is going to get you, which is absolutely nowhere. And then it launches into this great thing of things that we should do, you know, it's just a magnificent sort of litany, but it all comes to a climax in the final sentence of the poem is practice resurrection.
Right.
And it seems to me that the whole rest of the poem, and it's well worth anybody going away and looking at, is basically an exposition or a commentary on that one phrase, practice resurrection. And it seems to me that, you know, it's very easy with something like the resurrection, which is a contentious issue in amongst Christians and certainly in the wider world, it's very easy to sit down and just sort of have abstract conversations about the resurrection. What did happen? What didn't happen? What does it mean? Da, da, da. Whereas I think that he's caught something very powerful there by saying what we're really called to is to practice resurrection, to imbibe the living Christ, and to find ways to express that, not just in our personal lives, because a lot of that poem is speaking out into a much more political context and saying, this is the sort of people we need to be in the world. We need to be people who care about others, who care about the planet, who embrace mystery, and so on and so forth. It really is, I think, a very powerful thing.
And what's the name of that poem again?
It's called Manifesto, / The Mad Farmer's Liberation Front. I presume he's the mad farmer.
That sounds excellent. I must very definitely look that up. And if I was preaching this Sunday, which I'm not either, I would pick up that idea, practice resurrection. I think that's a tremendous
It's
theme.
A very powerful thought, isn't it? Absolutely.
So, Dave, you've been terrifically interesting, as I thought you would be. And I found it most enlightening. I hope people watching this have done as well. And thanks for being my first guest on this podcast. And I shall look forward to your next Pause for Thought script.
Absolutely. I look forward
Take
to that
care.
too. Thank you.